Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the episode-by-episode breakdown of Red Dwarf. I'm John, and I'm doing my first rewatch of the show in years for this podcast.
And I'm Fergus, and this is Groovy Funky Channel 27, where we talk to awesome and funny people about why Red Dwarf is so good, aided and abetted by Alex, podcast Kerala extraordinaire. This ep, Beck Hill's joining us to chat Series 1, Episode 2, Future Echoes.
Let's get out there and get on with it.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company had evolved out of the hologram he hates. Plus a fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why. It's better than...
Beck Hill, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Beck Hill,
you are a stand-up comedian, a published author, and a TV presenter. But most importantly, you are a massive fan of Red Dwarf. How did you get hooked?
I got hooked from an early age. My parents would watch it. And I think that's probably the best bonding experience I had with my parents was the family sitting around and watching various shows. And my whole family was always a fan of sci-fi and things like that, but it just had all the right ingredients. As a seven-year-old, like, you've got your sci-fi, but you've got your silly characters, and there's enough going on that even if you have no idea what's happening, it's still highly entertaining.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, from that point, I was hooked, I was a huge Thorough fan who, yeah, grew up pretty much watching it and quoting it the majority of my child and teenage life.
You gave an interview to a national paper where you talked about your family would communicate largely in Red Dwarf quotes for a while.
Yeah, we still do. We still do. In fact, for my mum this year, there's a brilliant comedian, musician, and now YouTuber called Greg Johnson. In fact, I'll send you a link to his stuff. He makes fantastic props out of just junk. And for a friend's wedding, they were big Red Dwarf fans. So he had made them a beautiful photo frame
yeah.
in the style of the Red Dwarf ship,
awesome.
Just like using junk and stuff. But it was stunning and it went down so well. That's right. It had a quote in it. He framed a quote that he got printed. I think it was the one about, "I've come to regard you as people I have met," because, you know, he wanted to be romantic. And, and he said it got such a good response that he decided to commission, I think about 10 of them or something, and said, if anyone wants one. And so I commissioned him to get one for my mum made that said, "I'm on the case, I'm sharp, I'm kicking bottom." Because awesome. I thought sometimes that's what you need for your, like, you know, affirmation. That's what you want to remember. I'm kicking bottom.
Absolutely. Yeah, that needs to be going around Instagram in a motivational quote form for sure. We can't mention Red Dwarf related craft without talking about the phenomenal piece of Dwayne Dibley paper puppetry, which is available on YouTube. We will put the links in the show notes, but could you talk us through how that came about and what it is for the benefit of people listening?
Yeah, I didn't even know it was still up. It was a competition. Like when I think when I first moved to London,
yeah,
I want to say it might have been a competition to be in the studio audience of the new series.
Oh, wow.
Something like that. I feel like it was before, as my comedy career has gone on, I've found that, oh, like people who I actually know have written on the show and stuff. But back then, yeah, I didn't know. Anyway, I had no zero connections. And I think it was to do that or win some sort of Red Dwarf prize, which I never won. I never got it.
Oh.
But it was, I recreated the polymorph bit where Kat has his vanity sucked out of him and first becomes Dwayne Dibley.
It is incredibly cool. Anyone that hasn't seen it needs to check that
Actually,
link out.
I say first, he does, it's not the first time, sorry. Back to Reality, I think, is the first time, isn't it? But it's a lovely return of the character.
Yeah, he goes full Dibley at least a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah.
Was Red Dwarf kind of a formative comedy influence for you? Like, was that a big part of your route towards becoming a comedy performer and writer, or was it just one of many?
I mean, definitely it was formative in terms of it was one of the things that made me want to write TV. What was really interesting was because I did a big rewatch of it sort of semi-recently, and I did the same thing everyone else did and did a massive binge of it during lockdown.
Right.
And my 2019 show that I did at Edinburgh Fringe was called I'll Be Back. And it was more of a theatre show than a stand-up show. It starts off as a stand-up show. And then, spoiler alert, I then interrupt the show from the future.
Sweet.
Using some stage trickery. It was really interesting watching, especially this episode, funnily enough.
Mm.
And this is all going to sound very confusing. I thoroughly recommend if anyone has a subscription to Next Up, the online streaming service for stand-up shows, you can watch the show on there. We filmed it in Edinburgh Fringe that year.
Oh, awesome.
One of the gags in the show, or sort of a gag, is that I ask myself how this works, like how does time travel work? And I say, well, you know how when you look at stars, you're actually looking at the light from stars that died years and years ago. Well, it's like that, but in reverse. And that's the explanation for how I go back in time. Like, that's it.
But then I
realized that that's kind of like not that strange when you compare it to Future Echoes, because that is essentially what they're saying.
Oh, I love that. That's really cool. I have to ask the hopefully not depressing question. When you did your binge watch, did you go all the way through right up to the present day series, or did you contain yourself with the classics? Where does your fandom end?
Yeah, I think I went to the end of series 8, because that was the series that I used to binge watch a lot growing up. And that's also that pretty much covers from me starting as a 7-year-old and then pretty much all the way up until they sort of took their first break. It was funnily enough, because I rewatch it fairly often. And I think each time I've rewatched it, remember the first, when people started complaining about series seven and eight, I didn't understand, because I thought I was just like, I just want more Red Dwarf. I don't care. This is great. But as you get older and you see what bits sort of really stand the test of time and like really stick in terms of not breaking boundaries as such, but really like being at the forefront of comedy sci-fi, like really absolutely nailing it in the same way that Community does a really good job of nailing TV satire and satirizing films and stuff, like really understanding the mechanics of those things. And I think Red Dwarf does that really well with sci-fi. It's the same with any show that I watch where some of the things that happen start to break the rules they've set up earlier.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I've got the same with Doctor Who. Like, as soon as some of the storylines contradicted what rules they'd actually set out themselves, I was like, well, no one cares now. No one cares. So why should I care?
I'm a bit of a completist, though, when it comes to canon. Like, that stuff's important, right? And as we're going to talk about Future Echoes, it ends with a big thing that you assume is going to be the series.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they don't seem to mind that. But that you'd hope for continuity. Series 8 specifically was such a highs and lows series, right? Every episode in Series 8 starts with Rimmer and Lister in a jail cell together.
Mm.
And so every episode just starts with that 5 minutes of banter, which is amazing every time. But then also it has ups and downs.
Yeah. And they're not great at writing women. We'll put it that way.
Oh, really? Okay. That's news to us.
There is a lot to unpack. hopefully not making it sound like too much of a slog for the listener who might be watching along with this.
Do you reckon anyone's going to watch Red Dwarf for the first time and listen to this?
I'd like to think so.
That's extraordinarily optimistic.
A big Beck Hill fan might track this podcast down just because you're on it, and they might go, ah.
Yeah, but a big Beck Hill fan is likely already a fan of Red Dwarf. So I don't think I'm introducing them to that.
There's going to be a very small subset of humanity that go, oh, I didn't know Beck Hill was a Red Dwarf fan. And that is our key demographic.
That's our ticket, yeah. Hello to you listening. I'm so glad that you were as excited about me being on this as I was.
Wanted to jump in quickly and ask Beck, how did you first consume Red Dwarf in Australia? Because I know, like, with me and 90s Simpsons, it was always 6 p.m. Reruns on Channel 10. So was it reruns? Was it video? How did you first see it?
That is a great question. And also, funnily enough, when we were talking about quotes earlier, that's the other thing that my brother and I communicate pretty much entirely in Simpsons quotes. Like, that's our thing. You and I are probably going to send each other quite a few texts now where it just says things like, I call the big one Bitey. but the Australian one, so it was on ABC that we'd first caught it because we've still got, or do we still have them? But we had like VHS tapes that we'd recorded it on too. And for years, I still had like those 90s Aussie ads. And it was the 90s. It was the ABC. I know it was the ABC because you could buy the videotapes in the ABC shop. And the ABC shop was an awesome shop. Did you guys ever have a BBC shop? Was that ever a thing?
There was a BBC shop in Brighton. I don't know if that was the only BBC shop in the whole of the UK, but there may well still be there, yeah.
Weirdly, in Adelaide, which is not it's the capital of South Australia, but it's not the one that people go to. in the shopping centre near where I grew up, there was an ABC shop. And it was awesome because it was just all of the merch for all of the shows that played on ABC. So you could get all your Doctor Who merch there. You could get Little Britain stuff when that was big. We don't talk about that now. and Red Dwarf stuff. So I remember you could get the box sets, the VHS sets when they came out, and my mum was able to, so we'd sometimes buy them, but they're quite expensive. So my mum would order them for the library because you could be like, well,
brilliant.
And then she'd immediately bags it as we got to be the first people to borrow it before everyone else did.
That's genius. Put yourself in that position of power.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Do you remember any of the like later seasons in that first run coming out?
So I remember when series 8 came out, there had been a competition at that time with TV Week and you could win a trip to the UK. And I sent in, and it was one of those ones where you send in an envelope with your details in it. And I sent so many in and I was gutted that I didn't win. Oh, I wanted so hard to win. But I think because of that, I remember being really excited when it came out. And, you know, there was a CGI dinosaur and that was cool because I love dinosaurs. So I was happy. But yeah, I remember the anticipation each week as those episodes came out. You'd be like,
oh, yeah.
Now, we're going to get into episode discussion in just a moment. But a question that we're going to ask every guest, which is really tricky, I think, but that's why we love it. If you were to recast a modern day reboot of Red Dwarf, who would you cast?
Okay, so I have thought about this multiple times. My first go-to thought was like, well, Rainn Wilson playing Dwight in The American Office is essentially Rimmer. Like, that's a very Rimmer, you know, character. Then I was like, oh no, Mackenzie Crook. But then I was like, no, I think he's too old now. He's got that beautiful wizened look that he's got going in The Detectorist and Wurzel Gummidge and stuff. So I'm like, you know what, he's on his own path now. But yeah, my first thought was like, right, if I was going American, I'd be like, it would be Rainn Wilson, his like sort of Dwight character. You'd have as much of someone I don't think I agree with as a person, but Chris Pratt's character in Parks and Rec as Andy, he's essentially a Lister, like a lovable slob. And so I was sort of piecing together the thing and I was like, no, but you wouldn't even be able to use them today because they're already too old. So I've been having another think and I've gone back to the British roots. I'd really like to see someone like Daisy May Cooper as a Lister.
That's awesome. Wow.
Yeah, I think she's like the perfect level of someone who could do annoying but like a bit lovable and slobbish, but like sometimes come out with these really smart thoughts and stuff.
Yeah, humanist, prideful, all the things that Lister needs. That's a brilliant choice.
So I think she'd make a good Lister. I think someone like Acaster or Nish Kumar as a Rimmer, I think. Not that they're like that in real life, but I think they could very easily channel that in as a Rimmer character.
This is not the first time Nish has come up as Rimmer. What is it? Is it the anger laced with self-loathing that he does so well that fits in with Rimmer? What is it about Rimmer?
When Nish is really hamming up his like rants, he goes into a similar place, I think, mentally. It's almost like the indignant, like he's so just annoyed at things not working the way they should. And it's a thing that we kind of do, that we relate to. And I guess maybe with Nish, a lot of the time it is stuff where you're like, well, I'm glad he's annoyed about this because you should be. But I think he could also really push it on things that aren't worth it.
Yeah,
sure.
Which is why I also think Acaster could do a decent Rimmer as well.
Yeah.
Marwan Rizwan would be Kat.
Nice.
He's got his new show out on iPlayer at the moment, Juice, which is beautiful. You know, he's been on the scene for years and I find him very funny, but he's also an incredible dancer and he has a really distinct style and he's already got a bit of a Dwayne Dibley haircut. So he could absolutely nail it. Crichton would be Richard Ayoade.
Love it.
Yep.
I think that he could realistically pull off a character who you're trying to teach stuff, because he is quite robotic in his delivery of stuff anyway.
Robotic and fussy, though, which is perfect for Crichton.
Yeah, exactly. And for Holly, I would have Diane Morgan or Anna Maxwell Martin. Even though they're quite different, I could see them both
different.
Pulling off a kind of an interesting Holly who's had enough of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Diane Morgan could be so disaffected and so aloof where I guess Anna Maxwell Martin would just be like brutally honest with the crew the whole time.
Yeah.
Both excellent choices. Wow.
Yeah, that's an awesome cast. I thought this question is a lot easier than I thought it was, or you have been up all night thinking about this.
No, it's some, do you know what? Not that one in particular. And I do have to give some credit to my husband because we've talked about this in the past. And we'd both sort of bounced off the British ideas off of each other before.
Do you know what? I really admire the constraint of not casting yourself in it.
Look, I'll be honest. That was my first thought. But then I think I've spent too much time pitching TV shows with myself attached. And now I think like a producer where I'm like, well, if I want to get this picked up, I'm going to have to go with a bigger name.
Oh, that's a shame. I'm sorry.
But hey, by the time this hypothetical recasting happens, maybe I'll be a big enough name.
Yeah,
there you go.
You can be the showrunner.
And then I would 100% be Lister, like 100%.
Awesome.
I would love to be a Lister. I think Lister would be, well, I'm basically Lister anyway. In fact, that is pretty much the relationship I have with my husband, because he is incredibly, he's very neat and tidy and likes things to be done in a very specific way. And I I'm none of those things. And like, I think even this t-shirt, like it's stained. Like I'm literally on this call with a stained t-shirt and everything I own has, I have one white jumper and I don't know how it's still white. Like it's to the point that if I wear it, my friends go, wow, white, that's brave. There is an iron shaped hole in our carpet because I tried to iron something on the floor because I was too lazy to take out the ironing board. So I think I could be pretty realistic, Lister.
Well, Beck, we need to start talking about Future Echoes, which is good news for you because it means that you don't have to answer the question that I'm dying to ask, which is, based on your Lister-like tendencies, have you ever accidentally deodorized with shaving foam? So we'll never know the answer to that unless you choose to volunteer it in the relevant portion of the episode. Just to refresh our memories of all the awesome stuff that happens in Future Echoes, Fergus is going to give us a little pricey.
Thanks, John. Series 1, Episode 2, Future Echoes. The episode starts with a recap from Holly, which is a really nice way of doing a previously on. He states that he has an IQ of 6,000. That's the same IQ as 6,000 PE teachers, although presumably that was measured before the 3 million years in which he went peculiar. Either way, Holly needs his wits about him. Red Dwarf is accelerating towards the speed of light and has galaxies and stuff to avoid crashing into. The plan is for Lister and Kat to wait in stasis until they get home, much to Rimmer's chagrin. However, that plan is jettisoned when the ship hits the light barrier and weird things start happening. Moments from the future begin to echo in the present, showing the Dwarf crew inevitable outcomes of their space-bound shenanigans. There's a shaving cut, a tooth gets broken on a robot goldfish, or does it? An ancient and vindictive Lister visits to impart wisdom and crack a practical joke. There's some medieval craziness. It all culminates in a tense life or death determinism versus free will kind of scene, which almost yields some really cool special effects. There's a lovely ending where we meet slightly future Lister and his two baby boys. How are kids born in a sterile environment? Will this happen no matter what Dave Lister chooses to do? And that's chooses in heavy inverted commas. It's a story beat Grant and Naylor will definitely come back to, we promise. So Beck, what do you think? Were you always fated to do this episode with us?
I find that stuff very... the way I see it is that we are fated, but we still get free choice. And I know that those two things sound like they contradict each other, but how would I explain it? It's like a book. Life is like a book. And so it's all written there and all the pages are there existing at once. Like if you look at the book, that is all of the time existing at the same time. But that doesn't stop the characters from doing what is essential at that point in time on the page when they make a decision. To them, that is a freedom of choice. They could make either decision. And just because the book is finished, the book would just be a different book if they made the other decision. But it's very hard to explain. But I do think that we get to make the choices because we only live in the current moment.
Are you talking about specifically the moment where Lister decides to go and face death and picks up a baseball bat to do so? Like, that seems like a choice he's making, right? But it's a choice to embrace his fate. Is that a thing?
Yeah.
It's a weird subject for comedy.
Is it a weird subject for comedy or is it perfect? Whenever anyone's like, oh, you should be able to joke about anything, it always amazes me that the people who say that choose to joke about things that they usually don't have the ability to do well. And I think that if you could joke about anything, then why are you choosing to joke about certain topics when you could be joking about, is fate like determinism or or do we have free will? Like, write jokes about that. There's way more stuff to milk there.
Let's start at the beginning of the ep just real quick. How do we feel about PE teachers?
My brother was a PE teacher.
Does he hate this joke?
I think he finds it quite funny. But then again, he is also a maths teacher and he ended up stopping PE teaching so he could do more maths. So I think he's fully aware that he's not one of the ones that's being joked about.
He's got an IQ higher than one.
Well, in Australia, PE teachers have a totally different... Like here, there seems to be a real like, ugh, PE, ugh. But in Australia, when I was growing up at least, PE was like the best. Everyone wanted to do PE because the weather's good. So you get to go outside. You don't have to sit in a stuffy classroom. And so like everyone was always excited about doing PE. And I mean, not all PE teachers were awesome, but they certainly didn't have the same sort of reputation that they seem to have here.
I think the issue is that if you attempt to do exercise or sport in this country, then that's tantamount to striving for success, and that must not be done.
Yeah,
Australia's got like the tall poppy syndrome also, but I think definitely in primary school when it was more games and they weren't really expecting you to be coordinated, it's quite fun.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, when you got to do the parachute.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Everyone loves the big parachute. Do you know that... Oh,
if we had parachutes in PE, we might have liked it.
It's a big rainbow parachute and they unfold it and all the kids sit around it and then you like get into this rhythm of like sort of as if you were, you know, slowly waving up and down a duvet cover or something. So it's all going up, but you can feel the force of the air rushing in under it as you lift it up and then like whooshing out. And then basically the aim would be to then get it up high enough that everyone would suddenly all run in together and then you'd wrap it and sit on it under your bum and sort of create this little dome and you'd all sit in there in this group as the dome like slowly deflated over your heads. And then you do it again. It was really fun. Maybe I should just buy a parachute and teach a bunch of people to do this in a park.
That sounds so cool.
It was so fun.
The last PE lesson I can remember is all of us standing around in a circle while someone in the centre had a heavy ball on a rope that they swung at our feet.
Oh my God.
That was the extent of
Isn't that a lesson?
And I,
what were you supposed to be learning
from
that?
The mundanity of cruelty? I don't know. Like, but something.
That is very much the reputation, PE teachers have in this country. I think for me, this gag, the IQ gag, to me, so strongly resonates of tell me you were always picked last for sports at school without telling me you were always picked last for sports at school. It's very much going on in the writing here, I think. I grew up in Wales, so PE for me was just rugby. That was it. There was only rugby. There was no other sports. Rugby is the only sport. And I'm phenomenally short-sighted. And obviously you can't play rugby in glasses. PE for me was just 2 hours every week of standing in rainy mist, basically half blind, trying to see a white thing before it hit me in the face. As soon as it did hit me in the face, being knocked to the ground by some over-muscled freak.
Yeah, that sounds awful.
I enjoyed this gag. It took me back to happier times.
And then the episode opens on this plan. And it's kind of interesting that this wasn't mentioned at the end of episode one. Like, are we going to turn the ship around, head back to Earth, and now they have the plan, well, Kat and Lister are going to go into stasis. That brings about a whole existential crisis for Rimmer, right? Not a crisis, just a series of complaints. But still, he's facing his own death again.
Yeah, and surely all you need to do is turn him off and then turn him back on again. I mean, for someone who hates his every aspect of his life, he certainly doesn't like the prospect of not having to hang around for 3 million years.
But fundamentally, he is a coward. He's all about that self-preservation still.
Yeah. Also, it is made very clear in this episode and in later episodes that he is terrified that if he gets turned off, he won't get turned back on again. Because why would they?
Yeah, right. That's a reality-based fear.
Yeah.
And interestingly, this episode was originally meant to be the fourth episode in the series and then was moved to the second one because they wanted to make sure it was very clear to the viewers that there were going to be some heavy sci-fi concepts within the show, and that was sort of the big thing that sort of was to pull people in as opposed to relying on the characters, which of course, as it goes on, you can rely more on the characters. But I can understand if you go straight to the third episode, which I believe is the one where I think Lister's trying to study to pass a chef's exam so he can outrank Rimmer.
Yeah.
Plot-wise, that makes way more sense. Like, it makes way more sense for that to be the next place they go, because in that one, it's, I think in that episode as well, is when Holly says to Lister that the reason that he turned on Rimmer instead of someone else was because Rimmer would keep him more sane. They know each other more than anyone else. They've shared more conversations, more words than any other character. And so it makes sense to him that Rimmer's the one he brings back. Which, if I just watched the first episode, that would be my first question, because they make it very clear in the first episode that the person that they bring back is someone who is like crucial to the mission, and then Rimmer's the one that's there. And so that's not fully explained until several episodes later, because they move this episode to the second to Future Echoes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think it was the fifth episode written and then the fourth one they filmed before a studio audience, and also it was supposed to have had the best response of those first four as well.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It shows what the audience need. It's brilliant to have a kind of quite deep sci-fi concept that you can have a load of jokes springboard from. Mm. Were you able to get your head around it when you first watched the ep, Beck?
Yeah, I think, again, it's that sort of, because your brain's more spongy when you're a kid. And so I think stuff like this, you kind of would go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Like, you just accept it. And it's not until you try and pick it apart later as an adult and verbalize it that you're like, that's actually a really difficult to communicate premise. But as a kid, you can totally grasp those things quite easily. I did a bit of a refresher on the theory of relativity, just because they reference it in the episode. And I was like, I remember being taught about this, and I found it so much harder to get my head wrap my head around than as I did as a kid. Mm. Like, I remember fully understanding the concept of if you had a twin that traveled away from Earth at the speed of light and then came back, they would be younger than you. I think that's right.
Yeah, you'd age faster than they would.
But even as I say that now, I can't fully understand why that's the case. But I remember as a kid being like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Like, but genuinely understanding, I feel like I actually understand things less as I grow up, stuff that I fully comprehended when I was younger.
That's a terrifying idea, isn't it?
It's a bit scary. My brain's atrophying. It's terrible, you guys.
Oh, no, maybe it's more that kids, we're willing to accept certain original just baseline facts that nowadays we might question a little more. I don't know, maybe I'm just being generous. Do you think this is why Lister is so attractive, potentially? He has that thoughtlessness is a bad way of putting it, but he shares that simplicity of brain, that's the same thing, as children, maybe. Like, he doesn't want to question things too deeply, maybe because he knows if he does, he'd go insane or end up like Rimmer. I think that's that's something charming about him, isn't it?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think he certainly asks more questions than Rimmer does. Rimmer is very much the sort of the adult in that situation who would get annoyed at or not believe something initially, doesn't like the idea of things. Whereas I think, but then Lister does sometimes struggle with accepting certain things and stuff, but it feels like a believable struggle.
It feels like the writers have deliberately taken someone with that struggle, but then put everything in his way specifically to drive him insane. So like this happy-go-lucky character, he comes in on his little bike wheelie thing and he's singing, I don't know if you noticed, a version of Clementine that goes, lived an old plutonium miner. Plutonium is quite a tricky thing to get into the scansion there. Plutonium miner and his daughter Clementine walks up to the vending machine, gives his code, which is Lister Dave RD52169. And there are 169 crew members, so pretty much that means he really is the bottom of the barrel. Just nice little moments that kind of galvanizing what we already know or think about him. Mm. But the thing that drives him crazy, like this, the food dispenser, giving him a bucket when he wants a coffee. I loved that so much as a kid. Like, how silly. But now as an adult, I'm like, I would lose my marbles in an instant if I was him.
I loved that scene because I hosted a show on CITV called Makeaway Takeaway, which is on ITVX if anyone wants to watch. It's an arts and craft show, but we had a little shoot that is very similar in the thing where I would put stuff in it and then it would sort of, I would make something for a viewer and then pop it in there and it would get whooshed away. Obviously, it's a set. Like, the wall isn't a wall. It's plywood, essentially. And the shoot needed someone to stand on a chair behind the plywood wall lower it on a rope or yank it up on a, you know, on a pulley. But they couldn't see you. So they had to be like, hands clear, because if they yanked it up or dropped it down while your arm was in the hole, then you would break your arm.
Ouch.
So you had to make sure that you didn't go anywhere near it if they were testing it. But I was thinking that, watching that, there's someone behind that wall. And the changeover is so fast where he's got the wellies. And then he asked for the coffee. And so this means that, like, someone's had to quickly shove in the bucket. The key is you never see the back of the thing. You assume there's a back to it, but there's not. It's hollow. So there's someone who's lowering it and someone who's quickly pushing out the tray that has the bucket on it so that then he can lift the bucket up. And I love thinking about those things. The people who are behind the scenes on the set having to do very basic, dumb things to create an effect that seems very... You know, it's like the doors on Star Trek, I think, were just stagehands pulling the doors apart and putting them together again. And then they just add the whoosh sound effect in post.
There's that glorious outtake. Do you remember from like series 4 or 5, Smegup, where Lister knocks on something that is clearly MDF.
It's meant to be stone. They're in the chimney.
And the audience actually laughs at it.
Yeah.
That's me. And he says they're going to sort it out in the dub. But covering up the cheapness of the BBC sitcom budget. I think they did really well. We're 3 hours into our discussion and only 2 minutes into the show. So let's move things forward a little bit. Rimmer is such a knob. I'm sorry. Excuse my language. He says he does the mile in 7:46, which I've done a bit of maths research. That means he's doing a meter every 1.35 seconds, which is pretty much the average human walking speed. What's happened? He's a hologram. Surely he can zip around. Do we get the impression that this is the only time Rimmer has ever done fitness? And he's only doing it so that he can run past Lister going, slobbing around in the afternoon?
No, I think he's that sort of... I think he's one of those people that gets great glee out of the performative side of exercise.
So, it's exercises that aren't necessarily actually making him any fitter or healthier. They're exercises that look big, that he can wear white shorts for. Pristine white shorts as well.
He's clearly not trying that hard. He just likes the idea of saying and looking like he's exercising. But it's clearly nothing that he's ever taken seriously enough to put effort into.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Was it their intention, do you think, to put a practical joke in every episode? Lister knows Rimmer, ancient Lister, when he visits. Come closer, come closer. He knows how desperate Rimmer's going to be. It's not remembering, it's knowing that Rimmer wants any information about how successful and how great he's become. And I love that moment. I think that's potentially one of my favourite moments in the episode. Do you have a standout moment, Beck? Is there a moment that just went, oh my gosh, I want my life to revolve around this joke or this scene or this idea?
Well, funnily enough, this episode made me want, and it's to this day, I still get this yearning, made me want a robot goldfish so much. Because it's a really nice little prop they've got.
Oh, yeah.
They do a really good job of making it look like it's... And that transition between then cutting back to Craig Charles just dropping a real goldfish into the thing.
It's really good cutting.
It's lovely. It's really nice. And I do love that. I think my favourite scene is when Lister thinks that Rimmer's talking to him, and then it's a future echo.
Yes.
And it's that first realization, and it's the moment when Rimmer then sort of leaves and then comes in from the other side, and then the whole thing happens again.
It's great.
And you have that lovely moment where he says, it probably is deja vu. It probably is deja vu. It sounds like it. And I just, when he fulfills that, it's such a satisfying moment. And Chris Barry does such a good job of recreating exactly what he's just done. Or should I say, the first time he does it, he does such a good job. The blocking of that scene is really satisfying. There's got to be a moment where Lister passes in front of him because that matches up with where his eyeline is going.
Mm.
And it's just those little things
it's
like
so
that.
Well done. I think Craig Charles is amazing in that scene as well, right? To play that what the hell is going on for such a sustained period, for it to all lock in.
That's true. Yeah, and he has to hit those marks so that it makes sense for where Chris is looking later.
Yeah.
It's a complex idea done very simply and very well.
Yeah, there can't be any fan out there who's watched that scene and hasn't gone, yes, that is brilliant. That is a core masterpiece. No wonder that they moved this to episode 2 and that the audience loved it so much. This is juicy stuff. The scene where Lister's about to explode potentially. There's genuine, maybe I'm reaching here, but you can hear it in the audience when the little explosion goes off. The audience go, "Ooh, there is tension there." Like they make it work, and I don't know how.
Yeah, and they can't kill him. It's the second, you know, it's even if the audience knew it was the fourth episode, they're like, well, he can't get killed. But then they did start the episode off by introducing us to a bunch of characters who they then all killed off immediately. So
yeah, that is true. Is this going to be an anthology? Shall we just get a new cast every couple of weeks?
Yeah, yeah. The thing that annoys me about it is, so they decide they're going to stay in status because there's no point being out of it, and he says it's going to take however many thousands of years just to turn around, but with a ship the size of a city. But then that makes me wonder, if they haven't turned around yet, or if they're in the process of turning around, why have they entered light speed? Are they turning around at light speed? When I think of light speed, I think of going in a straight line.
Yes, surely maneuverability becomes tricksy. at the speed of light.
I kind of like, surely you should turn around and then go into light speed. Like, why are you going
really
further away from where
down
you need
a bit,
to be?
Maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you're learning to drive a car, I hear you're supposed to accelerate into the turns. Maybe that's what Holly's up to.
Oh, maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe, are they Tokyo drifting, Red Dwarf?
That's clearly it.
It's not even Tokyo drifting, it's just drifting. But that's how little my knowledge of cars is, that I had to say the title of a Fast and the Furious film.
This has to be, by necessity, a sterile setting. It has to be an utterly scenario in which it is impossible to procreate. Procreation implies future, which implies hope, right? And the end of this episode goes, hey, we do it somehow. And I've got so many questions like, do you miss women in this show? You mentioned writing for women in this show. Like, do you agree with what I'm saying? Maybe I'm convincing myself as a bloke that it had to be all blokes. Or all women.
You could very easily have a show with people of different genders and go, oh, I couldn't imagine them getting on though. And in fact, we do have shows where there are people of different genders and you never would want them to get together or to be a thing. So I don't think that's it. I think in terms of the plot device of having the reveal of, oh, Lister's there with babies, how did the you know, what, just the mystery of like leaving that sort of thing dangling of like, well, if you keep watching, you'll find out how we explain the babies. Because that's an interesting thing that might make people want to keep watching and be like, yeah, how do they explain the babies? Like, what happens there? But I'll also say that the way that they explain it later on, and I don't want to spoil anything, but the way that they, like the episode where that's meant to happen got canned.
Oh, do spoil, because I'm not sure I know this.
So it was meant to be in, I think the first episode of series 3 was meant to be one where it shows Lister giving birth and not shows, I don't know what the idea was, but he would sure. He would give birth, and then that whole episode was about that, and then him having to get the babies back to the dimension where they were conceived, because in our dimension, the babies were aging at like way faster rate, and they weren't going to get a proper, it's somehow described, but they weren't going to get to live a proper full life. So they went back to this other dimension. I don't think I can't remember if they explain how then it happens that the one of them doesn't, because one of them is meant to die according to this episode, but then they take them, maybe it was to save them, maybe it was if, but then that goes, flies in the face of the whole theory of relativity and determinism and everything like that. I'll be honest, I think that this decision is a terrible decision and I would have got rid of it. I would rewrite it. I mean, you're rebooting it, so you can. And I think it'd be no one wants to watch the show. We know from the first series of The American Office that no one wants to see the same. In fact, they did two pilots, American pilots of Red Dwarf that no one liked, and they were using the British pilot. What they should have done is gone, right, well, how can we do this in a different way? We've got the same sort of characteristics that we're working with and the same premise of, okay, you're 3 million years from Earth, but how can we play with these? Okay, this Future Echoes, this is exciting. How do we use that and then do something new with it, do something different with it? So I would get rid of the baby thing, because to me it's like a throwaway thing anyway that they hadn't really thought about how they were going to finish. And then it ends up being one of Holly's like, previously on type, that's how they explain it away. It gets like two sentences before the start of the episode where how they explain what happens with the babies. So yeah, I'd get rid of that. I don't think it needs it. I think you could come up with a far more exciting thing that doesn't involve trying to that, and that then gets rid of the whole problem of, do they need to be seemingly physically unable to have children?
Thank you, Beck. That's an amazing response to that, and genuinely you've just opened my eyes to something I think revealing about my own fandom, which is that I clearly see series 1 and 2 as this self-contained little wee clo style, using that word sterile but hopeless, I guess is what I mean, where actually that's not what the show is. After series 2, there's loads of other characters that come in and start affecting things and open up the world, the universe. I have lots of theories about why the American thing didn't work. I have a theory. It's about being still versus journeying. Lister is aboard this spaceship in the middle of 3 million years into the universe, but he's not actually going anywhere. And I think the British sitcom, the situation, it has to remain the same. Change is not okay for comedy. So like, to a British audience, maybe it's quite nice to see someone not going anywhere. But Americans love a bit of a journey, right?
That's why Pam and Jim are able to get to it with each other in The American Office. And it still ran successfully for quite a long time after that, because
a few seasons,
everyone was like, oh, we've had some story arcs, this is nice. But by that stage, they've already become interested in a different storyline, so they're not like wanting more. Whereas the Brits, we tend to, I mean, I say we, I'm taking half my Britishness, but I'm saying that there is a propensity to go, no, this is the storyline, that's it, there's one. Whereas I think Americans are pretty good at being like, okay, well, let's introduce a couple of storylines.
Yeah, they are good at that.
So that we can wrap one up and then have some other ones going.
I don't think this undermines what you're saying. It doesn't fit, because what you're saying to me feels right, Fergus. But I wrote down the dialogue because it just struck me as what a difficult, again, Craig Charles has been given a really difficult acting job to do when it's revealed that it was Bexley, his son, who died, who Rimmer saw die in the future. And he has to be relieved that it wasn't him, but also he's just learnt that his future son is going to die really young. His response to this, I'm going to have two sons, isn't it fantastic? Rimmer, spectacularly callous, very British response, yeah, but one of them dies. And Lister's response to that is, everyone dies, you're born and you die, the bit in the middle's called life, and that's still to come. I mean, that's a lovely line.
Yeah.
That's very, like, that's not a very British way of looking at the world, right? That's much more American.
It's a nice line. It's technically a nice line, but what? So his son dies the same age as him And like, he had an issue with dying early. So why wasn't he at that time like, well, you know, I've already had the life that's in between those things. But I do know that Grant and Naylor both regretted the way that they wrote that.
Yeah.
And in the books, they changed it so it's his grandson. So that's there's a little bit more of a distance of like, well, I can't do anything about that. I'm not going to grow up watching this kid, you know, because at the time, that's what I imagine he would have expected, is that he would grow up watching this kid grow up. So, yeah, so they changed it to a grandson. And so it was, even though it's still callous, it's, it feels in, removed slightly more enough to feel less horrible.
Well, do you know what? I think we've really thoroughly gone over episode two, Future Echoes, scene by scene. I don't think there's anything more that can be said about it. I'm joking. We could probably do another 3 hours, right? But we have to have food and things like that.
Yeah. My two favourite catchphrases from this episode, I'm going to eat your little fishy.
Oh, yeah.
I've definitely said that multiple times. And for some reason, a line that's always stuck in my head is, and I think it's because of the little dance he does, which is, oh, groovy, funky, channel 27. And I've found myself saying that to people when they're saying like, oh, but what about this channel or whatever? And no one ever understands that I'm quoting Red Dwarf because it's not
what?
Like a big catchphrase. It's not a big, it's not like, you know, one of those very memorable moments, but it always sticks in my head.
Though.
I think it's the dance he does when he says it. I can't say it without wiggling my arms around.
It's got so much. It's such a good call. The dance that he does is so silly. He clearly has so much disdain for the kind of person that watches Channel 27. It's so real. And it's such a good world building line as well. I want to see this Channel 27.
Yeah.
It does sound hip and groovy.
Feels like very much like BBC Three or or E4. Oh, groovy. Funky.
And now it's time for Groovy Funky Channel 27. Talking of the BBC, there is just one tiny little thing I'd like to mention before we go.
Please.
The iPlayer description for this programme is incredible. It genuinely is like, we found out on the first episode, it's like whoever writes the blurbs for iPlayer, there's no way they've seen the show. There's no way. So if you'd indulge us, I'm just going to read the iPlayer précis for this episode, and we can discuss whether or not they hit the nail right on the head there. Having accelerated for 3 million years, Red Dwarf breaks the light barrier and Rimmer sees a death in the future.
I mean, they're sort of not wrong.
Oh, no, they're not wrong, but they are wrong.
I mean, they do make it sound like Red Dwarf has been getting a 3 million year run up.
Yeah, we're just jumping on now.
Into travelling at light speed, yeah.
It's the acceleration that is key to the story as well, clearly. I think that's the fascinating thing about it. That is, you're right, it's not wrong. They're not misinformed about what happens in the show, but they are misinforming us as to what happens in the show.
Yeah. It's like putting the wrong emphasis on the wrong things.
Just imagine like going to a restaurant and going, oh, could you tell me what the what's the penne alla rabbiata, please? And the response of the waiter being like, well, after 12 minutes of boiling the pasta, you pour it onto your plate. It's like, okay, but do I want to eat it?
That is the perfect analogy for this. Yeah, you've nailed it. I think from this episode onwards, you need to get guests to rewrite do a one sentence copy for what they would, how they would explain that episode.
I feel bad about giving you homework. You already had to watch the episode again.
If it was homework, I wouldn't be on this show.
Sweet. That's an amazing thing to say. Thank you. And on that note, thank you so, so much for doing our silly podcast. Thank you so much for being a big enough fan of Red Dwarf that you'd speak so well and awesomely about it. Thank you, Beck Hill.
Oh, anytime. Always happy to ramble about Red Dwarf.
Beck, before you go, if people have enjoyed your musings on Red Dwarf as much as we have, where can they find you?
Yeah, or if they want to argue with me, I'll take it. They can find me in all socials, Beck Hill Comedian or Be Chill Comedian, if you read it wrong. If they want to hear more maths-based stuff or me getting maths wrong, but with someone who gets maths right, then they can tune into the podcast I do with Matt Parker, which is called A Problem Squared.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Beck Hill there, absolutely magical guest.
That was great, and I have a feeling we're going to get a lot of different perspectives on this show.
Oh yeah.
Like, I thought I knew it really, really well, and so that's two for two in terms of having my mind peeled apart.
Yeah.
In discussion of this programme.
Yeah, it's awesome hearing people who've, I mean, obviously I'm coming back to it for the first time in a few decades, but people who've stuck with it all this time more faithfully than I have, and just the takes that they've got on stuff and the interpretations they have of what it's all about. It's going to be super interesting, I think.
Yeah, we covered so much with Beck as well.
Yeah, we did.
Not many stones left unturned.
No, as will, I think, be part of the course, we're going to turn over all the stones. We're going to point at them. We're going to explain what they're doing, why they're doing it. We might disagree a bit in a friendly way, and then we'll respectfully put them back how we found them.
Let's find out. What stones have you got that need turning right now?
There's just a tiny little pebble that I want to flip over first and examine. And it's just a little moment. It's a little Rimmer moment, which I think might be a recurring theme for me because I'm just obsessed with the little things Chris Barry does. But he's talking about his father, and he refers to that rather unfortunate suicide business. And it is just such tar black humour. But if you take it as a genuine thing that someone is truly saying in a real fictional world, if that makes sense, what a thing to say. Like, we talked about his signature before. That really gives you a sense, that rather unfortunate suicide business, how deeply squished down his emotions are, his true feelings, and why he gets so annoyed at frivolity is that it's just, they're like, the things that Lister annoys him and his rage at that is just, oh, there's so much darkness just bubbling up from within Rimmer.
Is there any gallows humour in that, in his personality and using that phraseology? No one says something like that without knowing that it's a shocking phraseology. Mm. I have a friend whose cat recently died. He's not a sociopath, nor a particularly emotionally stunted person. And he was clearly upset by the death of his cat, but the way he announced it was, it's only a cat, who cares?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because sometimes that's like a thing that people do to spare other people that difficult moment of switching into, knowing how to switch effectively into commiseration for something that hasn't literally just happened, and not knowing where to sort of, you know, how to console. He's not looking for any of that, is he? I don't think he's fussed about making other people feel safer around that. But yes, I mean, I do agree. He's I don't think that's just face value how he feels about it. He hasn't convinced himself that rather unfortunate suicide business.
This is a tricky question anyway, isn't it? I could imagine that line being said to great comic effect in Blackadder.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Lines like that occur in Blackadder all the time.
They do.
But you never question, unless we start doing an episode breakdown podcast of Blackadder, I don't believe people generally question the legitimacy, the performative truth, the character background to certain jokes, which are just idiomatically funny rather than having a rug pull or anything.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, well, Blackadder's, a huge amount of it is just the joy of sarcasm, isn't it? And the inventiveness of the language that they can employ in the service of vitriol and insult. Whereas this does feel like it's a signpost of something about Rimmer's emotional state.
Yeah.
Which I don't think they're doing that in Blackadder. This is telling us. I mean, you're probably not meant to go into it as deeply as I'm trying to do now in terms of thinking about its psychology, but I do think it's scripted to tell you something about who this guy is and what's got him here.
Yeah, no, you're right. It does. There's a lot of stuff there. It's the second episode as transmitted. Mm. So, like, that is a bombshell for a character and our understanding of it. Eons ago, I wrote a pilot that went out on Sky.
Oh, yeah.
The first time an exec producer saw the script, they asked us to cut loads of character references. The logic being that anything you put in your pilot, you have to stick to.
Huh.
And so rather than filling the pilot with character notes that will evolve and be referred back to throughout the series, their advice was actually not to have any of that, so that you can be free to write an episodic, almost non... You're trying to get rid of the seriality of it.
Mm, right.
Having Rimmer's dad having done that to himself, I think that's... I can't remember if they come back to that. I know Rimmer's dad appears in the series later on.
Yeah.
Not this series, on the show later on. The crazy question about Grant and Naylor and their attitude towards the story in Red Dwarf, do they care? Do they feel that they have to refer back to things they've planted? Or because there's evidence in both ways, right? There's evidence they do not care a jot for continuity and can lampshade stuff and brush off stuff with a bit of Holly voiceover. But at the same time, they do refer back to stuff. They weave a web.
Maybe the answer to that question is it's both then, that they care about it if they find something interesting to do with it. But if they don't, then they're happy to just, not so much pretend it never happened, but they're just happy to leave it where it was, kind of thing.
Revisionist. They're revisionists. They're revising their own history.
Yeah, I don't necessarily mean that they sort of retcon, although they kind of do, I suppose, maybe, from what I can remember. It's hard to say.
They should do what Marvel are doing and just make it a multiverse. That way, every episode takes place in a different universe. That way, we never have to worry about continuity at all, and everything's fine. And there are no stakes.
Yeah.
I think referring to it as rather unfortunate does fit in quite well, like Rimmer's repressed character, or even, like, if he was a child when this happened, it's sort of the euphemism that his family might have used to refer to it. That he's just picked up on and internalised, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's really nice. Yeah.
That's the most likely thing, in fact.
Yes.
Given his intellect, what we find out about his intellect elsewhere in the show. I never twigged that he's not that intelligent, and so maybe he is just repeating things parrot fashion. I think I just responded as a kid to that accent. I was like, all right, okay.
Something else I like that I don't think we touched on with Beck is the Scutters in this episode. And incidentally, this is the first time they're named. They're just the service robots in episode one, but now they're the Scutters, as we'll come to know and love. But their letter, please don't leave us with Rimmer, and banging their heads against the wall. It's just so great.
Yeah.
I love that moment.
Yeah, that's brilliant. They were so limited by the puppetry.
Yeah.
And let's not question how they wrote that letter, even printed it out without scrunching it up in their weird three claws. But they tell exactly as much of the story that's needed to be told.
They do.
Again, the despair of spending that time with Rimmer is enough to make a robot smash their head against the wall.
Yeah. I love all the little things that we see about them, about how the Scutters have spent the last 3 million years. I mean, they've spent it quite well, haven't they? They've got into movies. They've learned how to write three-fingered. That probably didn't even take that much of the 3 million years, did it? Frankly, in that time, they could have given the place a bit of a lick of paint, couldn't they? They could have done more with it.
That's tricky. I think in 3 million years, they would have given it a lick of paint.
Oh, which would have then eroded.
And then run out of paint, and then that was still leave a couple of million years.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, God, it's possible that they did like cycle through several evolutionary stages of art, and now it just looks like Roman ruins, where someone has to stand there in a high vis going, of course, originally this would have been very brightly coloured.
yeah, that's it. I think if you actually apply the law of entropy, I don't think Red Dwarf would still be there after 3 million years at all. Red Dwarf collects space debris in that big funnel that we see at the front of it. It has an internal engine, so all the stuff gets turned into fuel and fuel into power through its central core. And then gets flushed out the end hole at the back.
So it's like Mr. Fusion in Back to the Future, just turning any old nonsense into what it needs to.
Yeah, occasionally if they find a really big lump, there's a story behind the big rock that's attached to the bottom of Red Dwarf that they use for mining while they travel. But yeah, an engine that big, doing that for 3 million years. I think the Scutters have done extraordinarily well.
Oh, they have.
Not to be just fine particles of sand floating through space by this point.
It's possible that they've evolved, but because they didn't shoot off into space in search of something better, we're just now seeing like the decline of Scutter civilization, and they're back to sort of just be doing menial tasks for superior beings. After 3 million years, your tolerance level for a Rimmer suddenly turning up and trying to boss you about would be quite low, I think. In fact, just somebody like moving your favourite cushion could be enough to send you into a homicidal rage. So on that level, they're doing quite well.
But hang on, we know from iPlayer that this thing's 6 miles long and 4 miles wide. There's space for everyone. It's ridiculous that Lister and Rimmer continue to share a bunk at all, frankly. They're still there together in Series 2. The Scutters could have anywhere they want.
They could. Well, maybe. Okay, so maybe the Scutters are reacting to Rimmer's posh voice as well. And it's just activating a kind of inbuilt servitude. Oh, speaking of robotic beings, though, Talkie Toaster crops up here. I'd forgotten he appears this early. I felt like he was strangely underused, but that's just because I can remember what happens to him later on.
I thought that as well. When he first popped up, I was like, oh, this is the episode where we get the list of bread products. Yeah. I guess you could add Talkie Toaster to the list of things that don't work on the ship.
Yes.
It's just another appliance that is over-programmed. There's no need for any of these food dispensers to be able to talk. It's good that they do, so that they, I guess, have some of the monotony. of each other's company broken up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like how they record the voices as well. They're not too Dalek-y. They're not too... But somehow they are a bit robotic. Maybe it's a very subtle filter they're putting on, or something the voice actors are doing. Or it's that I watched this when I was a kid and now I have that association with that kind of voice. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know. I've realised something as we come to the end of this second episode of the show. I think we are going to be talking about Rimmer a lot more than Lister. Clearly, we have lots of points to mention about Rimmer. And not a huge amount to say about Lister. But I don't think that's because of any paucity in performance or writing or characterisation.
No, not at all.
Literally, just that Lister is such an open book.
Exactly.
And that Craig Charles plays him that way.
Yeah.
And he's written to be, you know, everything. He wears his heart on his sleeve kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. What you see is what you get. Whereas with Rimmer, you just know that there's so much churning under the surface. And speculating on what it is just a lot of fun.
We mentioned recently that it feels like all of these characters are written specifically with these actors in mind, these actors in habit. But then actually, there's one character, an actor maybe we shouldn't say that about, which is Chris Barry, right, playing Rimmer. Because if, God forbid, he should be 10% of Rimmer.
Yes.
There's so much to explore. There's so much to look at. And Lister does get more. They're all brilliant characters, but there's so much to talk about. But in future episodes,
we'll talk about all of it. Don't you worry.
That's episode 2 for you. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Yes, indeed. Where we will be watching episode 3, Balance of Power, with Suze Kempner.
Awesome. See you then.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.